Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo.
Morning.
I am traveling, but I do have my cup of Joe. I just don't have the Ortho Joe mug like you do.
I've got my branded content, as always, always.
And as I introduce our very special guest for this edition of Ortho Joe, I want to assure Dr. Richards that he will be receiving a custom Ortho Joe mug to enjoy your favorite warm beverage. So it's my great pleasure.
I hope I don't have to pay the customs fee on that. I might have to declare its worth.
It's priceless. So I don't know how you do that. So our guest today is Dr. Robin Richards of Toronto, a native of Guelph, Ontario, farm boy, as I understand it right, has had many leadership positions in orthopedic surgery and surgery departments, the chief of orthopedics at St. Mike's, and then moved his career to Sunnybrook, chief of surgery, and also major leadership position. He at one time took over as a very young orthopedic surgeon, a disaster in its making, of the World Congress of Orthopedic Surgery that happens every 6 years. It was due to happen in Toronto, and it was a fiscal disaster. And Robin, as a very young orthopedic surgeon, took it over and salvaged the whole thing. But also major leadership positions in the Ontario Medical Association. That's what I want to get into. But so Robin is a leader of leaders, I would say. And he does it by very detailed preparation and understanding who he's negotiating with, and with the most dry wit of any person I've ever seen. Also, and the last point I would make is that he's a promoter of others, I believe. The good Dr. Bhandari was at one point a student under Dr. Richards. So this is our very special guest, Robin Richards. So Robin, can you just give the listeners a sense of what was going on in orthopedics in the province of Ontario when you were dealing with issues that you found creative ways to solve?
Well, there was a new government, and
What was the year, Robin?
Oh, it's in the 90s.
Okay.
I can't remember the exact year, but it was a new government. It was called the Common Sense Revolution, and they got a majority. So, it's a parliamentary system. So, if you got a majority, you can do anything you want. So. They took away, instead of giving us fee increases, they supported our malpractice payments. They took that away. They put a cap on a clawback system. If you made over a certain amount of fees, they start clawing it back. It was sort of an austerity thing that made it almost impossible to practice, especially if you were in a high-risk specialty like obstetrics, orthopedics, neurosurgery, or general surgery, because we had really high malpractice premiums in relation to the other medical. It's all together as GPs and specialists, so it's all one big pot. So it had a differential effect on specialists versus family doctors, to the extent that I started looking around in other countries, because I couldn't see. I could sort of raise four kids and do what I wanted to do with this huge clawback situation. So the more you worked, the less you got paid. It was just unacceptable. And I've always thought that you should never accept the unacceptable. So it was unacceptable. That's how it started. And then we didn't really know what to do. So the Orthopedic Association had only about 300 members. So we polled the members to see how far they, you know, how upset they were and how far they were willing to go. And then we hired a lawyer to try and figure out what we could do and what we couldn't do. We were quite selective in who we hired. It was a lady who specialized in, at that time, there was a review committee that if the government said that you overcharged, they would have a review and claw back, you know, funds, your fees. And this was very unpopular. In fact, it eventually was dissolved because a physician eventually committed suicide because of he got an adverse finding. But we hired a lady that specialized in that kind of work. We had to use her quite judiciously because she was like a pit bull terrier. And then we formed something that colloquially was called the Goon Squad. So the sections of general surgery, orthopedics, obstetrics, and nurse surgery got together and decided that we couldn't accept the situation. So that's sort of how it started. This was without any help from the medical association, who thought it was sort of totally okay to work with the government at that time.
That's, and how did it turn out?
Well, it was a 6-12 months of pretty intense activity. It was very time consuming. It was a whole lot of meetings, and eventually, you know, we met with the leadership of the medical association, and I sort of would always take someone with me that had a cooler head and play sort of good cop, bad cop. And eventually I said to the CEO and the president of the medical association that there was going to be a wrecking ball rolling down the street, which the legislature and at that time the medical association were on the same street. It's changed now. Actually, you could see the OMA office from the legislature. I said, we were getting this wrecking ball. We had the wrecking ball together. We were going to roll it. We just hadn't decided whether we were going to roll it at the legislature or roll it at the medical association office. And if they didn't believe me, I knew that the obstetrics leader was sitting outside because I saw him on the way in. And I knew that they cared a whole lot more about obstetrics than they did about orthopedics. And I said, if they didn't believe me, they could talk to the next chap that was coming in. And make a long story short, they agreed to demand a negotiation with the government, because the biggest thing the government had did was rip up our agreement. Like, we had no agreement. So that was probably in a public healthcare system, which ours is in spades. If you don't have an agreement, you've got, you know, really nothing. You're just a slave. So eventually we started having forums. Like today on the national radio show, they're having a forum in Victoria, people talking about healthcare. It's like deja vu all over again, because there's a crisis again. It's things are in a horrible situation here. And so we started having those kind of things. It got into the newspaper, and eventually, public opinion turned around that it was that the government was causing the problem rather than the doctors. So we got the public on our side. And to make a really long, to bring it to the conclusion, the health minister, the premier's office called me, said, well, what can be done? I said, it was all cryptic. I said, well, you know what the problem is. So if that problem goes away, then we can talk. And so about 3 days later, the health minister took a walk. Like I said, I'd believe it when I saw it on a photograph or a video. So it wasn't replaced, but he stepped aside for 3 or 4 months while a deal was negotiated. We had a good deal that lasted quite a while, actually. So it was the best of times and the worst of times. So.
If I could just jump in and ask a bit more broader question, which is, you know, you've held a ton of leadership roles throughout your career, and I can't imagine there aren't a bunch of early career, some mid-career, folks will come up to you, Robin, and ask a little bit about, you know, taking on leadership roles and insights you have about them. But what do you tell someone earlier in their career who, I guess, has either an illusion, delusion, or maybe they're appropriately correct in saying that I really want to focus on administration and leadership as my, you know, focus? How do you guide them in that role? Or do you dissuade them? I don't even know. Maybe you dissuade them. I don't know. But
that's hard to answer. I mean, I think the number one thing in surgery in general is to be a leader, you've got to walk the shop floor. So I learned that really early on, because in the summers when I was in university, I was a steelworker. I was a card-carrying member of the United Steelworkers of America. And we had a union hall, and, you know, we had, there was management, and then there was the shop floor. And a good leader in that factory environment was someone from management who actually would walk around the shop floor once in a while. So if you want to be a surgeon and a leader, that's great, because surgeons need leaders, for sure. But I think step one is to walk the shop floor. And then step two is to, since you're walking the shop floor, you sort of will know what is needed. Like, there's different kinds of surgeons. There's academic surgeons, community surgeons, surgeon scientists. But step one is you got to know what is needed, and you've got to have goals. And then you've got to, leadership is sort of like hitting the sweet spot. You want to be sort of on one end of the bell curve, but you don't want to be right out in that real tapered part where people think you're out to lunch or inappropriate. So that's kind of a farm boy answer, but sorry for that.
No, not at all. In fact, you know, I'll give you an example that just happened 2 days ago. So there's, a mid-career surgeon and, really aspiring to do clinical trials. And, you know, has got a protocol and basically wants to do a multinational study, but has made no real attempt to contact colleagues in other places, has made no real contact to go visit people. And I think it gets back to, and by the way, the study's failing. And, you know, they comes and asks, and I guess you're right, that's exactly what is the analogy. He hasn't, in this particular case, it's a him, but he hasn't taken time to walk the floor, as you would say, metaphorically, get out there in the community, meet with people, understand why they're not getting involved in the problems, and do that. And I think you get degrees, you get all sorts of insights. And, you know, we send a myriad of surgeons to leadership training, and they come back with a host of insights. But I think the bigger challenge for them is what you've stated, is the ability to communicate those insights in a way that connects with people. So that's actually a very, very helpful. Is there ever a time, Robin, I'll jump one more, Mark, because I have one more question to ask. Is there ever a time where you would dissuade somebody? I mean, truly dissuade them from saying, taking it on? In other words, you know, everyone goes on about thinking about how great it is to lead because they have this, you know, fantasy about how, you know, how it would be great when I'm a leader, when I'm the chief, or when I'm the chair, or whatever. Are there moments where you would say, well, you know, there are some real drawbacks to leadership and here they are?
Well, that's the kind of conversation you'd have to have in private. And that was one of the best parts about being surgeon in chief at Sunnybrook for 11 years was sort of recruitment and retention. I met every staff member once a year, and it was amazing to me how far, roughly 60 staff. So it was amazing to me how far some people went in that time period and how some people didn't go anywhere or regressed. So I don't know that there's much downside to leadership, except you have to be realistic. You have to have the credentials, you have to have set goals, you have to have good interpersonal skills. I mean, you talk about your colleague about a multi national study. I mean, one of my biggest regrets in leadership was that I was chair of the research committee of the American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeons, and I sort of went around, Mark alluded to stakeholder analysis. I went around to leaders throughout North America to try and get them on side for our American Shoulder and Elbow Surgeons assessment technique or outcome analysis, which was supported and adopted. But that was a big big change. I should have gone worldwide. You weren't around then. I had no idea that if I had it to do again, I would have gone around the world and got to worldwide shoulder and elbow assessment, because we're still grappling with the too many assessment systems. So that was a mistake. So that's not a very good answer to your question. But there's only so much time and only so much energy. So I don't think there's any point doing leadership unless it's in your gut, right? You got to feel it in your gut. You got to say that, you know, I feel something needs to change, and you got to feel that it's probably best to go around and ask a few people, talk to a few people, seek their advice. So I don't know what advice you gave to your colleague, but it sounds like you got to get the stakeholder, you got to do the stakeholder analysis before you try and move forward.
Yeah, I would say it becomes priorities, right? The priority is you're going to have to give up something to get something. Reality is, I think there's this perception that I want at all. And you'll have, you know, and I think the expectations on a lot of faculty coming in to academic centers per se is that they're expected to, you know, lead, they're expected to be top tier educators, they're expected to be excellent surgeons, they're expected to do research. And the reality is it just doesn't happen, right? It's rather rare to have someone being able to do all of those things. And so it's a choice. And this individual just was having to make a decision, a tough decision about the choice. How much energy was he willing to put into this? Because what you put in is what you're going to get out. And that was kind of the discussion. But
yeah, nothing's easy. I mean, we appoint people with a memorandum of agreement. They're either surgeon teachers, surgeon scientists, surgeon investigators. But 3 to 5 years after you're appointed, there's a continuing appointment review. And if you commit to something and don't follow through, then, you know, not everybody makes their continuing appointment. So you have to, I think, a junior person maybe needs a mentor, needs someone to counsel them on what's realistic. Like, I'm going to be a leader. Well, you know, that's a sort of a chicken or egg thing. I don't know. I mean, what's that mean exactly? So talk is cheap and deeds count.
Right. That's fair.
So, Mo, if it's okay with you, I'm going to take the last two questions. The first one, it will be clinical, Rob, and I think it rather straightforward, but the last one will be about your role as the editor of JBJS Open Access with Eng Lee. But the clinical question, as a shoulder and elbow surgeon, what is the biggest change that happened in, let's say, shoulder surgery during your career, the most positive thing that happened?
Well, I thought you might ask me that. So I thought you'd ask me, what are the biggest changes, period? So they're really not that many. I mean, when I started, low friction arthroplasty had just started. So that was a really good thing. And then as far as trauma goes, the intramedullary nail came along. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, and you are too, but I shouldn't say that, but maybe you are too.
No, I am.
Of beds full of guys in traction, another beds full of girls in traction. Yeah. The IM nail was a big thing. And then came sort of outcome, patient-oriented outcome analysis and and evidence-based medicine, multinational studies. But for shoulder, there's really only been one thing, and it's got to be, well, maybe two, I guess. Well, one really. I mean, one would be arthroscopy, but really arthroscopy is just doing the same operation through the scope that you did open. But the real big change has been for sure the reverse. I mean, the reverse shoulder arthroplasty. I mean, why didn't I think of that? I mean, I mean that's just completely changed shoulder surgery. You don't. I remember the first one I did. I couldn't reduce the thing; it was too tight. And the resident said, and I did go to a course before, so it wasn't like I tried to wing it. And the resident who'd been up all night nailing a femur or something, he said, "Well," and he had to go home at noon hour because of the rules. He said, "Dr. Richards, you don't need a rotator cuff for these things to work, right?" And he says, "I said, no, you don't need it." He said, "Well, why don't you just cut all the rotator cuff?" And so I did that, and then it reduced, and the lady was fine. It's like a miracle. So it's a bit of a good news, bad news thing, because in Canada, it's a zero-sum game, they call it, but it's not really a game. But, I mean, the budget's, there's never enough money, so reverse is twice as expensive. So when I started doing these reverses, the hospital actually stopped me doing arthroplasties for a while. It's too expensive.
Yeah.
So I went to the CEO's office with that book, The Shoulder. You know, it's in two volumes. I put both volumes on his desk. I said, "You know, Mr. CEO or Dr. CEO, there's only one person that's got multiple chapters in both volumes. And he's standing here in the room with you." And he looked at the book and said, "There's a book on the shoulder?"
That's great.
So that's been, to me, a great change, because it's reliable, and people don't have nearly as many sort of useless or semi-useless operations that don't work very well, because the reverse works pretty well. So
last question. As editor, co-editor with Ang Lee of JBJS Open Access, I think it's year 5 now, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm not sure. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. What are your thoughts about how we're progressing? And you always do, but tell the truth. How are we doing?
Well, what it'd be for other people to say. I mean, it's. The goal when we started was to publish the second tier of manuscripts that almost got published in the what's your current term, the flagship journal. Is that it?
Yeah.
It's been sort of steady. I think it hasn't been catastrophic. It hasn't been a huge growth. I mean, the journal, boy, I can remember the first time I saw a journal was at St. Joseph's Hospital in Hamilton in the mid-1970s. It was when the journal had that soft cover. When you look at those days to the journal now, the journals, you know, because I'm not just involved with OA, I also review for the flagship, for Case Connector, look at reviews. I don't know. I think I can't really say, Mark. I mean, I look down the list of the things that Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, right? Surgery. So I look at the articles we publish, and I think they're interesting and hopefully relevant. And if we can publish them whereas they weren't going to be published before, that's a good thing. And I think the overall good thing is that the journal has such a suite of it's very extensive what's available. It's a huge difference in the last 5 or 10 years. So, I mean, OA's just part of that. I think the big change has been the expansion of the suite of information, including for the orthopedic assistants. It's a big thing, I know, in the U.S. and to a lesser extent in Canada, but it's amazing what's available. It's fantastic.
Well, Robin, thanks for spending the morning with us. And I will note to the audience that in addition to being a world-class leader, Robin is a world-class fisherman. who pursues the great fish all around the globe. And he's, the reason why he's dressed up is because he has a, I don't know, some fisherman's meeting coming up. So Robin, you will receive the, priceless Ortho Joe mug, and we'll cover the customs for you. So go catch the big one at the meeting tonight, if you would.
Okay. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for listening.
Oh, it was great. Thanks so much.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.